our discussion last time about, you know, what does it mean to talk about headship or kephaleship? By the way, I went back. Did you ever do this where you go back? Like, I think I wrote something about this. So I actually wrote a piece about Jim Halpert and male headship. So if you look for that, that's somewhere online. I missed The Office, except for the eighth season that was horrendous. And I kind of recovered a little bit in the final season. But I still can't even look at James Spader without... Right? Wasn't he on that?
Yeah.
That was a bad move. But here's the question, I think, as we look at the issue of thinking about within marriage. And one of the questions I had is this. Can or should a husband submit to his wife? How would you answer that question?
Well, of course.
Okay.
The Bible says that to submit to each other.
Okay. Others?
Yeah, I was going to say there's mutual submission there.
Okay. So when we think about submission, that's, I think that's one question to ask because it can help us clarify whether or not we're using the word submit in the same way that the Bible is using the word submit. Because I think there are some who would say that the wife should submit to her husband, but the husband should not submit to his wife. Well, if you say that, part of what that clarifies is you're using the term submit in a different sense than Paul is using it in Ephesians 5:21. And so I think one of the big challenges with this is to try to get our, right, we use words all the time, but to try to think about what does it mean in our practice for this to function in this way. And so I was thinking about, you know, so I would say last time, part of what I presented is that for the husband to be the head, the focus here is on loving his wife as Christ loved the church, that he treats her, he essentially sees himself as a servant to her, the source of life-giving love for her. And so part of my question is, how is that different from other positions, whether that's Piper or others who might emphasize, place a stronger emphasis on the fact that this does mean authority or rule or leadership. And so I was thinking about this. So yeah, think about different test cases. Would you say that if a husband as head, now let's take that in a more leader authority kind of sense or ruler, does that mean that a husband, you know, if I'm at Cabela's, not that I would be at Cabela's, but whatever, some people go there, apparently. So if I were at Cabela's and, you know, saw something that I wanted that costed upwards of $500, could I say, well, ultimately, I'm the head, I'm the ruler or leader, I don't have to consult with my wife before spending that money. Okay, so I would say, as somebody who, you know, that I would de-emphasize any sense of leader or ruler, and I would emphasize a sense of life-giving love that I'm called to be a servant for life. I'm trying to see, is there any difference in substance, or do some of us just like to use different words? And say, no, I believe that there is this sense of leadership where the wife is called to follow authority, but then I'm wondering if when we start to flesh that out in terms of details, does that mean anything different? So would you say, and this is where I think especially of the saying, the husband is called to lead, the wife is called to follow, if that's kind of the position you take, would you say then that there's kind of a difference there? You know, a woman would need to consult her husband on major purchases. A husband would not need to consult his wife, because he, in some sense, is responsible for providing the leadership.
I would say even if he's leading her, he should consult her because he's leading her to consult him. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So in substance, though, then the actual process of what that would look like, you could have two people that use these two different words and two different models, but in terms of process, we're still saying, what do you do? If there's a major purchase, you would want to consult with each other and be clear about that and go back and forth on this. And so part of what I'm trying to ferret out is whether or not there's if the difference is linguistic, we like to use different words, or if it's actual practical difference. And so this is, you know, so I kind of wonder sometimes if we're fighting about words, and in people's actual marriages it doesn't look any different. Now, I'm not sure. I want to say, of course, because this is kind of my bent, I want to say, well, I think that shows that you like to use the terminology of rule or leadership, but in practice, it looks more like servanthood, life-giving love, that it's not any kind of hierarchy, that there's a sense of mutual love and self-giving, and this is just, this is what you do, whether you're the man or the woman, and you're thinking about making big decisions, of course you would do that. Yeah, Maris, let me call
it. It's interesting because I, growing up, I saw both aspects of that, of like the rule over, and then, so my grandparents are very much like that, very traditional. And so my mom grew up like that, and like they couldn't talk back to their dad, like whatever he said goes, and my grandma kind of like just followed him and did whatever, like, and not in a bad, like, he wasn't abusive or anything.
Yeah.
That's just how it was.
Yeah.
And then my mom married my dad, who's very much not like that. And they've been married for 22 years, and she still struggles with having her own opinions, even though my dad is very much, just because she grew up in that. So it's interesting to see both aspects of that.
Yeah. And to try to think about, is that, in what ways is that good or is that bad?
Right.
Or would we just say, not morally maybe good or bad, but helpful or unhelpful or something like that?
Yeah.
In the book I'm reading, it talks about how the call of the man to, you know, love his wife as Christ loved the church and give himself up for her is almost a higher call than it is to submit, because it's more, from the perspective that I was going to read, it's more holistic than just submitting. Because submitting, it has this almost a bondservant type ideal, but the to give himself up is a whole thing.
Yeah,
and it's like every decision, and so it's a mutual. Of course you talk to your wife about that.
Because
it's not about you; it's about the common and
And that's where I think. So even somebody, is that Tim Keller, right? So even somebody like that, who I think still kind of wants to say there's this dimension, wants to use a word like lead or maybe occasionally authority, but I think when you actually describe it, part of what I'm asking is, why aren't you just saying servant or somebody who gives himself completely for this person? It's kind of a servant leader thing, right? I get that there are people in positions who are leaders and that a good way to be a leader is often to be a servant. But why say servant leader when you're talking about the husband? Why not just say servant? And I struggle with that a little bit.
I think a lot of it might be tradition.
Tradition.
Right.
Tradition.
Because it's something that's just been going on and on since.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why a lot of people still.
And that's where I think sometimes we like to, we've used these words, we like to use them because they give us some sense of like, we're safe because we're within the tradition, when in fact our actual practice is not traditional. And so it's a little bit like, here's a story of something that unfolded at our church a few years ago. In some of these discussions, there were some folks who were very firmly, the husband is the head, and that means leader. I think clearly a sense of authority there as well. And you had this unfold. I remember there was an older man and his son-in-law. Right, so they, in some of the discussions we had around this, they were very firm about this. This is about 6 months, a year after we had some of these more intense discussions in the context of our church. And the son and his wife ended up leaving our church for reasons not necessarily connected to any kind of this discussion. But then the mother, right, whose daughter and son-in-law had left the church, the mother decided, and she, different times adamantly had talked to me, the man is the head, we need to affirm this, this needs to be what we do. She decided she didn't want to stay at our church either. She wanted to go where her daughter and son-in-law were going, even though her husband had grown up in our church, had been baptized there, had, been there all his life. And so this couple was in an awkward situation where she decided she was not going to come to our church anymore, and he kind of split his time between these different churches, and eventually has kind of gone with his wife. Now, part of what, again, I think the irony there is that you have people who are saying, you know, we must use this traditional language is very strong and very affirming about the man as the one who's the leader and authority, and actually not practicing that at all. And so this is where I do kind of want to press and say, if we're going to use language, let's be as clear as possible about what we mean. And so if we are saying there is an element of leading, ruling, something like that, but if I were to say, well, okay, does that mean the man is ultimately responsible for all the financial decisions? Or that he's even primarily responsible. People start saying, well, and then they say, well, does that mean he's ultimately and primarily responsible for the education of the children? And he's ultimately the one who makes that decision with consultation from his wife, but it's ultimately his decision to make. Or about where you live, or what church you go to, or what the job situation is going to be like. And when people start saying, well, no, well, no, well, no, well, no, well, no, then I say, well, then what are you actually talking about? Does that make sense? Am I being too harsh? Mm-hmm. I am being a little bit... I mean, I'm trying to be adamant about this because I do think it's important that we say then what, in my mind, this is where I want to know. When I talk to people, then what is the difference? And if what you described to me in terms of male leadership and authority and rule is simply self-giving, life-giving love, right, taking the initiative, then I think we're actually talking about the same thing. I think our actual practice is going to be the same thing. Even if we sometimes use different words. So here's another question. Maybe we won't get to the PowerPoint at all. Who cares? So I'm going to list some activities, and you tell me if this is a masculine or feminine activity. Sports. cooking.
Everybody just saying both.
First thing that comes to your head. First one was masculine, second one was feminine.
So you can't say both.
Just say both for everyone.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
All right.
Oh,
shit.
Everybody's scared to say one.
Everybody's scared. Right.
It's a silent ballot.
Silent ballot. All right. All right.
Heads down.
So, yeah. Every head bowed, every eye closed. Yeah, yeah. We'll try to make this work. So you want to say, you have to say one or the other.
Yeah.
All right. Okay then.
No. Yeah,
but that's not how that's not how we all think though.
Okay. So we can't even agree about the ground rules. I'm trying to determine which of these.
Why don't you just say what you like?
Activities.
As a man or woman.
Like, okay.
Does that make sense?
I still
get it. So what about that statement? As a man, I express my manliness by... Right? Is that what we're saying?
Because technically you could say every single one of these could be both.
Okay.
But like...
Well, we only heard two, so...
But every single one could be both. Every single one could be both.
So would you agree every single one is going to be both? No matter what I say?
Yes, it is.
Okay, then somebody... Okay, then let's work at this from a different angle. What kind of thing would you say that we could not respond both to? That is not a purely physical thing, right? Like, okay, like having babies. Because, you know, when we talk about masculine or feminine, we're not just talking about reproductive bodily organs. We're talking about socially, psychologically, culturally, what counts as masculine and what counts as feminine. I mean, how about this one, having long hair?
That's not
both. Okay.
Give me one that's not both.
Chopping wood.
We need to have a wood chopping contest right now.
Playing Barbies.
Playing Barbies?
Ooh.
Now.
I got a story about that. Both.
So does that mean girls can't? Yeah. Does that mean girls can't play with G.I. Joe or Star Wars?
Right. There's obviously gonna be both for two, but the majority, you would say.
But we're not asking what can male and female do. We're asking what is masculine, what's manly,
right,
and what's feminine.
Well, I feel like everybody's just saying polar because they're like, oh, it could be.
Okay, could be either, could be any. Yeah.
That just change. Like, what is masculine and feminine?
Okay.
Because I wrote my blog on this last night, but I only wrote it on one specific part. But in my book, they talk about what was considered masculine and feminine in the ancient. Up in the ancient world, and it's complete, like, things like drinking and to the point of drunkenness were considered masculine, and now I think girls get drunk all the time. I mean, maybe not a Kuiper, but my friends in high school got drunk all the time, and that wasn't like, oh, she's such a man for getting drunk all the time. It's just everyone did it.
Yeah.
So doesn't what's masculine and feminine like change a lot?
Okay. Yeah. So there's a shift. I mean, this is part of why I mentioned the hair thing, because there's still, I'm wondering, like, how many men here, if you start to grow your hair long, would receive comments maybe from your grandparents or somebody else about, you know, when are you going to cut your hair? Or, for female students, if you went home with a haircut looking like mine, minus the beard, if you went home with a haircut like mine, what would people say? I mean, isn't there a sense in which even though we would say, you know, having long hair in our culture doesn't really mean that, but isn't there a sense in which that those are still kind of markers that at least some people in our culture look to? Yeah, I don't know who is first, Becca and then Silas.
I was going to say, even to that effect of the haircut thing, I grew up attending Word of Life events. I don't know how many of you guys have heard of Word of Life. It's kind of like Young Life, a little bit different, kind of a different spin, more Baptist than anything else. But
oh, I know all about women.
I have several classmates who have gone to Word of Life over the years, both youth group classmates and school classmates. And up until last year, the rules hadn't changed since the 70s. You were not allowed as a man to have hair that touched your ears at all. You were not allowed to have facial hair at all.
Because the hippies did.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Right, which is, and let me stop you there for a minute, because that's where it's interesting. You go back to ancient culture, and you read especially for Greeks and some Romans. Like, if you were a man, you should grow a beard. I mean, this is what nature has given to mark you as a man. And by the way, it also said men who cut their hair for stylistic reasons as opposed to functional reasons were acting feminine, which is interesting. So it's like functional. You're talking like your basic bowl cut, whatever hat. You know, that somebody gave you this haircut as a dude, you know, your freshman year in the dorms. We're like, yeah, I can cut hair. You can't cut hair. Right. And you're just like, okay, well, it's not touching my ears and it's short, but that's about all we can say for it. So I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think that's an interesting example of how you have Christians.
And even within that context as well, I got scolded by a youth leader when I cut my hair off because I hated having long hair. I still prefer not to have my hair long just because my hair is horrible and awful to manage, and it's just easier to my liking to have it cut short.
Interesting.
And I actually was scolded after youth group by my youth leader for having a veiled haircut in seventh grade.
Yeah.
When really, I unfortunately looked like Kate Gosling from Final Cake Plus 8 more than anything else.
All right, so yeah, so it's interesting examples there. Silas, were you going to follow up?
I was just going to say that on Saturday, my niece, who just turned 4, I was at her birthday party, and then she says, why do you have girls hair? I don't think
I have
girls.
I do
look like a girl.
So, like, even with the beard?
Girls don't have beards. You look like a girl.
Wow. So I think it sounds, we're still struggling, it sounds like, to come up with something we would say, this is absolutely for all times and places, only masculine or only feminine. Danny, are you going to chime in?
Yeah. And in my book, I was talking about how any woman who cut her hair at all, even if she just cut it like to chin length or to shoulder length, was
considered doing a masculine task because she wasn't supposed to cut it, it wasn't supposed to grow, which seemed interesting to me. And then when we were talking about churches having opinions on haircuts, my church growing up, what one came to the faith was Pentecostal, and the Apostolic Pentecostal Church used to come and visit us, and the girls there don't cut their hair at all, ever, from birth. So they would have, like, braids that were just down and, like, to the floor. And the men were to have short hair, so they would have short hair, but their hair was like their crown. So they had hair that was insane, like painful. The girls had neck issues, it was so long. It was insane to see. So I don't know where that tradition really comes from.
Yeah.
But just
yeah.
The subject of cutting hair, I thought that was interesting.
Sort of takes it to excessive.
Yeah.
Excessive proportions. To the point where, yeah, it is interesting to think about how this functions, because then it inhibits you from, in some ways, doing some basic human functions. Or it says, here, half the people need to spend a lot more time maintaining their hair, which takes some time, than the other half of the people who don't. Yeah.
At least until recent times, and even today, war has been an almost exclusively man-oriented thing. Like, even today, you know, they talk about female soldiers, but it's a gigantic minority. The tiny minority of war has been almost exclusively, and through 10,000 years of history of alpha men.
This is a big debate right now that actually is going on about exactly what, you know, can women do everything in the army that men can do, and why or why not. Yeah.
And it's not just about, like, numbers either. There could be a feminine activity that 50% are guys and 50% are girls. I said there's just as many guy cooks as there are girl cooks, but that just means we have a lot of feminine guys. Mm-hmm. Couldn't you say that? It's not strictly numbers, is it? You could say there's a feminine activity that's 50-50.
Yeah. That just means
there's a lot of feminine guys.
Yeah. And so is that...
That just means, like, today, guys can embrace their feminism more.
Yeah. Or, I mean, that's so... Important. Yeah, but so this is where... So would you say... Because then I think you're stuck with thinking about there's a couple directions you could go. You can either say, maybe we're starting to realize that there's nothing inherently feminine about cooking... Maybe this is a human activity that, for whatever reason, has been associated with femininity.
Right.
But now we're realizing the activity itself is, you know, there's nothing inherent in the activity that is somehow more fitting to men or women. And so instead of saying, well, it's only feminine men who like cooking, or it's only masculine women who like sports, that you start to say, well, maybe that kind of strict division of these things, or this kind of strict labeling, doesn't make as much sense as we might otherwise think. Now, this is where you can get into debates and discussions deeper than we're going to go today, but to think about, again, I think there is a sense in which biology, psychology, culture, these things are all intertwined. There are some actual differences between men and women in general, in terms of how our body chemicals, physiological processes affect us. But I think it gets very tricky when we start to say this activity is a masculine or a feminine activity. Is it helpful or harmful when to think about a label like tomboy? I mean, is that so? To call a girl a tomboy, aren't you kind of saying like you're kind of less of a girl, or not? Or are you just saying, well, you're a girl who acts like a boy? What's that? Or you're not a girly girl? Whatever that means. Does that affect girly girls? Or even think about, you know, why do we, this maybe goes the other way, maybe there's more derogatory, a derogatory slant in this, but what about when boys or men call boys sissies, right? To say you're a, Right? To say you're a sissy, right? It's kind of, you're a sister, you're a weak sister, you're a, right? You're a, why are you a sissy? Right? It's almost like, why are you acting like a girl? Because that's what girls do. They're weak and they cry. And they, right? That's, I mean, isn't that though the implication? That to me, that's the implication of saying, right, this is something, so many hands, Yosef, maybe, and then Carmen.
I mean, it's interesting what we ourselves as individuals attribute to these words as well, and how we experience them. Someone's called, I mean, two girls called tomboys might, depending on their circumstances and their, I don't know, their, I lost the word. How they've been fostered, grown up.
Yeah, they're.
They might take the word differently. Someone might be offended, whereas the other one is fine, and they embrace it.
Yeah.
It's difficult to generalize. When speaking these words, because everyone's experience looks different.
Yeah, but it does imply, doesn't it, that a girl who's a tomboy is not sort of fully girly girl, right? There's a sense in which you're, you know, again, if we think about a spectrum, it's that way. And I don't know if there's more or less association with a girl who acts like a boy versus a boy who acts like a girl.
Yeah, but what value do they attribute to being male or female?
Yeah.
In their circumstances and gender fluidity, I don't know.
Yeah.
And all kinds of things.
Yeah.
I think, and this is just my perspective, but like the word tomboy for a girl, usually, I mean, for different individuals, some girls might rather not be called that, but typically it's not that negative. Like it's just, oh yeah, you're more rough, you're good at sports, you're, you know, but then if a guy is called like a girl or that he's acting like a girl, that's a very negative thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
You know? Yeah, yeah. But it seems to, I mean, it seems to imply, doesn't it, that there is some sense of inferiority or superiority, at least to men. Maybe women would say, oh, you're acting like a man, oh, that's a good thing. I don't know if you've been trained to think that men are better, or maybe just different. But usually when men, at least in my experience, when boys or teenage males say to each other that you're acting like a girl, that's not generally taken to be a positive thing, right? That's a slam.
It's a big slam.
I don't know if people even use that term. Where did that come from? Anyway, Cyrus.
I was going to say, like, my book talks about that a lot, about Yeah, she talks about the blue playground and the pink playground, and how women, a lot of times, women are encouraged to explore and play around in the blue playground, but if boys even, you know, step foot in the pink playground, it's, you know, they're immediately corrected, immediately reinforced. And as far as, so like my own experiences, I've never been a super masculine, you know, kind of, I had a lot of quote unquote feminine interests and things, and there was a lot of pushback that I experienced.
Mm.
You know, not necessarily from my parents, but from peers and stuff, you know. So, you know, I didn't like sports, I didn't like the traditionally like boy things,
yeah,
and that, you know, but there's a lot of like pressure to conform. And then, you know, and then I think that gender is, you know, I mean, we should still maintain like a Christian worldview on gender, but as far as our cultural views on gender, they're not quite so hard and fast as like.
Yeah, yeah. So that let me get to this video. We're at least going to get through one slide today. This is the philosopher of Judith Butler. Answering this question about what does it mean to say that gender is performative. So this is just about a three minute video. But I'm interested to see how you think it connects or maybe doesn't with what we've been saying thus far.
It's one thing to say that gender is performed, and that's a little different from saying gender is performative. When we say gender is performed, we usually mean that we've taken on a role, we're acting in some way, and that our acting or our role playing is crucial to the gender that we are and the gender that we present to the world. To say that gender is performative is a little different, because for something to be performative means that it produces a series of effects. We act and walk and speak and talk in ways that consolidate an impression of being a man or being a woman. You know, I was walking down the street in Berkeley when I first arrived several years ago, and a young woman who was, I think, in high school leaned out of her window and she yelled, "Are you a lesbian?" And she was looking to harass me. Or maybe she was just freaked out, or she thought I looked like I probably was one and wanted to know. But instead I just turned around and I said, "Yes, I am." And that really shocked her. We act as if that being of a man or that being of a woman is actually an internal reality or something that's simply true about us, a fact about us. Actually, it's a phenomenon that's being produced all the time and reproduced all the time. So to say gender is performative is to say that nobody really is a gender from the start. I know it's controversial, but that's my claim. Think about how difficult it is for sissy boys, or how difficult it is for tomboys to function socially without being bullied, or without being teased, or without sometimes suffering threats of violence, or without their parents intervening to say, maybe you need a psychiatrist, or why can't you be normal? So, you know, there are institutional powers, like psychiatric normalization, and there are informal kinds of practices like bullying, which try to keep us in our gendered place. There's a real question for me about how such gender norms get established and policed, and what the best way is to disrupt them and to overcome the police function. It's my view that gender is culturally formed, but it's also a domain of agency or freedom. It's most important to resist the violence that is imposed by ideal gender norms, especially against those who are gender different, who are non-conforming in their gender presentation.
So here's how I want to kind of take what we've talked about a little bit and think about this from a specifically Christian angle, because Butler isn't necessarily coming at this from a Christian worldview, but to try to think about how our culture making is connected to our gender making. She talks about the fact that when we think about gender, it's not just innate in some sense. I think she would say there's such a thing as biological sex. But that when we talk about gender, that it is very much, much more so the function of culture than it is of just this, this masculinity or femininity inside of me that just, happens to manifest itself in this way. It is worth pointing out, I think, that all cultures do have some kind of gender roles where there are things that are assigned. Now, this is where it gets a little bit tricky because I'm going to put, this is what we're familiar with. Masculine and feminine. I don't remember who's. I think one or two people are reading the book The End of Sexual Identity, where in that book she talks about the fact that there are cultures that have more than two genders, right? Where you start to have three, four, five, six, where you actually do get classifications that include, people in our culture. Yeah, this is where it gets difficult to try to map on how our culture might talk about it and how other cultures map on it. But, we talk about transgender or gender fluid, or we talk about even to say feminine men or masculine men. Maybe those are different classes of genders in and of themselves, right? That when we start to think about how this works. But all cultures generally have some kind of gender roles. But the trick is, of course, not all cultures slot the same things into what counts as masculine or what counts as feminine, and so that's where things get a little bit tricky to say. It looks like the fact that there is gender roles is universal, but what counts, how you fit things into that, is not universal. Yeah,
but not every culture has the same amount of gender roles allotted, so they manifest more strongly. There's a lot more gender-defined roles in certain cultures than in others.
Yeah. Some of them are more rigid in terms of saying, this is where you go back and you say, you know, 100 years ago, short hair is you're here. If you have short hair, that's masculine. If you have long hair, that's feminine. But that has shifted, that has changed. So yeah, so there are different levels of rigidity between the different genders. But when I talk about gender making as culture making, I think it's important to recognize in the beginning, God gives humanity this power to create, to cultivate, to use language, to make meaning, right? Not just when we talk about making culture, we're not just talking about making things like tables or chairs or computers, but we're talking about how is it that we make meaning out of the world around us. And that different cultures do this in a variety of ways, that when we talk about cultural diversity as a good thing, part of what we see is that different cultures make meaning out of the world in different ways. That even to think about the differences that are embedded even in language itself as differences in terms of how we make meaning and how we produce that. And so I think culture making is something good. Part of how God has wired us as human beings, that we look at the world and that there is, you know, when I look at the world, there is a certain givenness to what the world is. In other words, it has a certain isness. It's there before humans fully engage with it and make something out of it. But human culture doesn't just say, well, this is the way the world is. We say, how do we take this givenness and how do we continue to make something more out of it? That this is part of, you know, you look around and you see trees and you say trees are lovely, but you also say, well, you could use those to make houses. And now you're going beyond just the givenness of creation to make something. And so when we think about how this works, this is what Mary Stuart Van Leeuwen suggests when she thinks about this process of she doesn't use these exact terms, but I think of it as this process of culture making through gender making. The constant invention and reinvention of gender roles is an expression of our creation-based sense that women and men need each other. Therefore, we search for ways to symbolize this need. The observance of gender roles and rituals remind us that men and women are incomplete without each other. And so I think what's interesting about this is she's trying to account for the fact that there is this great diversity. When you look at how different cultures think about what counts as masculine or feminine, there is this constant process of movement, of inventing and reinventing what counts and what works in that way. But she's saying the sheer fact that there is this sense of difference helps us to remember that it is male and female who image God together. It's not merely male or merely female. And so you have this process of invention and reinvention. Yeah.
So doesn't that then, the implications of this understanding, I think I agree with her, that those who try to move like Sweden then to more equalize and less make less rigid difference between the roles, thus only create more individualism in a way.
Yeah.
Or self-sufficiency and thus distort the God-given differences or that need for each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. That you wouldn't want to. Well, this gets into the next slide. So let's pick up on this, because I think there are a couple problems that I think that could emerge from this understanding. I think one problem is that people could say, well, given our power as culture makers, we can just erase any kind of male-female difference and act as though there is no difference, when clearly at the very basis, you know, there is this biological difference in terms of who we are as sexed male and female beings. I'm not dealing here with the question, the interesting issue for theology and philosophy to think about in terms of intersex persons. That's a whole other level of discussion. But I think clearly, in general, there are these basic biological and sexual realities. And so that, you know, this is where sometimes like, well, you know, say, well, if women aren't cooking and men aren't sportsing, how will we know, how can you define who's a man and a woman then? Well, there's still your basic difference, even if she's out there sportsing and he's cooking, right? However this works. And so I think we want to stay away from this kind of movement that you do see. And I think, I don't think it was Sweden, maybe it was Norway. This was in an article. I don't remember which. Maybe it doesn't matter that much. Does it matter that much?
But would you want me to call this Canada?
It doesn't matter to me.
Fine.
I'm thinking in terms of, yeah, if this is how you figure out who's Canadian, who's American. I learned this when I went to Canada, is that you say, yeah, Canada, America, they're all about the same. And Americans are like, how dare you?
You're very different.
And this is the problem, though. What you see, well, you alluded to it, you know, you alluded to it as well in your context, is that when we think about how, when we think about how this functions, some of these countries have moved to saying, we're not even going to assign a gender, male or female, at birth. There are some who are advocating for doing that, to say we're not even going to make that move. And I think that's a problem. I think the second problem is moving the other direction, and this is what Dorothy Sayers gets at a little bit today. She was a contemporary of C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, actually disagreed pretty strongly with Lewis on some things. But I think there's a problem here is that oftentimes what we do is we end up erasing our shared humanity when we say this is masculine and this is feminine. Then what that means is, well, you know, if you know, you go back in the way that Aristotle thought about it, if it's if thinking and reasoning is a more masculine activity, why would you expect women to take part in that? But that's not a, in some sense, the male is kind of the prototypical human, and the male does these prototypical human things, but the female does these kind of distinctively female things. And so there's a danger, I think, that we would erase our shared humanity. And this is where I think, from a Christian perspective, it's okay to recognize the fact that individuals are individuals, that we shouldn't simply think about people according to their, you know, well, you're a man, so that means you must function this way, you know, according to these very rigid boundaries of what that looks like. Or you're a woman, so therefore you have to conform exactly to this. Because as soon as you do get people who don't conform to those standards, then I think you risk taking something that's cultural, right? The ideas that we've created around gender, which are may not necessarily be bad or good in and of themselves, but you take something that's been produced culturally, and that now becomes something that's actually harmful for people because of the way that you're saying you must conform to this. And maybe this is, again, I alluded to this last time, but sometimes I wonder, is it masculine to sing love songs to another man? And does this explain why dudes don't come to church? Like, there is some gender bending there, isn't there? Right? Song of Song. I mean, think about even the, you look at Christian history where, you know, some of the, you know, some of the folks who've been deepest into spirituality say, the book of Song of Songs is really about me and Jesus. Okay. That's uncomfortable for some men, right? To think about this paradigm of sexual love as being a pointer to my relationship as a man with Christ. How do we think about this? And so even in terms of how we interpret Jesus, right? When we say, well, Jesus is the paradigm of when we have our paradigms of masculinity, and then we think, well, Jesus was a man, he must have been the true man. So if I think of masculinity in terms of, let's say, a distinct activity like war, and you say, well, Jesus is going to rough some people up because he was a true man. Right? Regardless of what the scriptures actually say about Jesus' posture toward enemies, we make Jesus fit into that stereotype. And so we have to be careful, I think, that we recognize individuals within that. But here's what I do think is a problem that we're faced with somewhat today, because we do recognize how much these gender norms are culturally constructed. I think we're very aware of that. We're very aware of the way that we, in our culture, produce and reproduce this meaning, and then we say, you know, girls must like Barbies and boys must like G.I. Joe, when really, you know, I just, would it change anything if know, G.I. Joe was labeled, you know, a Barbie for dudes. Like, or dolls. Like, why don't we call them, like, dolls? Like, they call Barbies Barbie dolls. Why don't we call them G.I. Joe dolls? They're action figures. Right. Which is interesting. If they're for boys, they're action figures, implying what's the feminine? Well, they're passive figures. Right? Then actually this... Yeah, I've got a video about this too in a minute, even though you can see it. But I think here is the problem, is that part of what Van Leeuwen alludes to is the fact that you do in all cultures see these different gender roles. Well, when we start to say gender roles are absolutely culturally produced and therefore serve no value and have no function, we start to, I think, have a sense of being adrift in terms of, well, what do? There are cultural scripts that guide our lives, right? Whether you like it or not, at a certain point in American history, the cultural script, for some people at least, is, well, what do? You go to high school, you go to college, you get married, you get a job, you settle down in the suburbs, the man goes off to work, the woman stays at home with the children. That's the cultural script. Is it a timeless script? No. It is something that's produced. But it is a script that enables you to have some sense to know what should I do? Here's what I should do. I think part of what we're seeing is in our culture today is there's almost no script. Right? There is no script. So what do people do when there is no script? They are stuck with having to manufacture their own script. You did?
Sorry.
You guys are conversing about this? Bring us into your conversation.
Okay. So we're talking about the same thing with like the Barbie and dolls, and we were like, well, what about purse? Because like there's a thing of purse, and then people go around there like, no, it's a man purse, or like, no,
right.
It's a satchel.
Right. Like, there's a Seinfeld episode about this. There is. Yeah, so even in terms of, is this something where in our meaning we're really we're still trying to say there's a difference here? And I don't think saying there's a difference, maybe that's not bad, but I wonder if some of that, what's driven by that is because as a man, you wouldn't carry a purse, because that's a feminine thing, right? That's almost like an inferior thing.
What are you
carrying
a purse for?
What's that?
What are
your dude stuff.
For what?
Footballs.
Pigskin, the Nerf,
your books. Your books.
Yeah.
And your computer.
I need my phone and my keys and my wallet. That's it. What else do I need? Actually, I also my chapstick.
Well, this is why. I mean.
I always have. Yeah, maybe.
You have pockets.
I have pockets. Yeah,
no, why don't women have pockets?
Because they're persons.
Because they wear leggings.
They wear leggings.
Because men design women's pants.
And there's no room in those pockets.
There's none.
Interesting.
I can fit like a quarter of my phone in my pocket.
So female pockets are not meant to actually store things in.
How do you know?
They were not meant to carry.
Sometimes
it just looks like a pocket, but it's not actually.
But it's not actually.
That's not what it is. All right. I love pockets.
No way.
So, but they have like giant wallets and like.
Have you seen
wallets?
Yeah. There's some dude wallets. Again, another episode of Seinfeld. Have you seen? George has this huge wallet.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Like it throws off his back. It's like he's got chiropractic problems because he should be carrying a man purse for his enormous wallet.
If you have a big wallet, you are prone to a back problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you sit on a lump,
yeah. Okay, so, I mean, again, this is just interesting to think about how, even in something as simple as this, it's become clear that there are different standards even for clothes, right? That, what's that?
Cargo pants.
Yeah, cargo pants. yeah. Danny, were you going to chime in here?
No, I got it. Well, just on the subject of dress and stuff, Judith Butler is in my book, and they talk about her book quite a bit, that she speaks in the lesbian community a lot about breaking down their divide into, I guess, lesbians can be like the masculine or feminine, so there's like lesbians who are like lipstick lesbians, and Judith speaks a lot as to not doing that because that's constricting themselves back into the culturally inflicted gender norms. So they talk about that a lot. I think it's really interesting that we're talking about clothing because she speaks into the lesbian culture as to don't do that because you're just reverting back into what like restricted you and suppressed you.
Yeah.
And tells them not to do that. So I think it's interesting that the gender divide is being spoken to as this like super oppressive.
Yeah. Thing. Well, and that's it's interesting even to see how that works through the history of clothing.
Yeah.
I read an interview with I forget the name of the actress who was on Downton Abbey. Even just talking about the kind of clothes that they have to wear, she's saying, I can't breathe and concentrate and focus. Like, it's no wonder as a woman you couldn't, you know, go through some of the same educational processes because you're literally just trying to survive in the clothes that you're supposed to wear. And there's other, you know, studies in terms of damage that's done to women's feet because of the kind of shoes that they're meant to wear, which I think gets at, you know, Sayers talks about the different, you know, trousers, right? In her day, this was like, should women wear pants versus skirts or dresses? And she kind of alludes to the fact that, you know, why do women wear dresses? Not because they're just so comfortable and because when you live in Michigan, it's just wonderful to go to church on Sunday morning wearing a skirt or a dress, right? That's like, that's not practical, right? I grew up in a church where that was considered the norm for Sunday morning. Occasionally, somebody would scandalize the church, and a woman would wear pants on Sunday evening in church. But now, most churches don't have Sunday evening church anymore, so we got rid of that problem.
Problem solved.
So that works. So I think we're thinking then about how this works. What we need to avoid is what Christina LaSalle Peterson talks about in her chapter, Mistaking the Industrial Revolution for the Garden of Eden. That sometimes when we think about what fits into these masculine and feminine norms, we look at a specific time period in history and say, namely the Industrial Revolution, and say this is what looks normal in the Industrial Revolution, at least for middle and upper class families. You know, as Sayers points out, for poor people, it's never been a question of should men and women work. For poor people, everybody works. Because you're trying to survive. But part of the point that Sayers makes that I think is interesting is to see the shift in our culture from a productive household to a more consumptive household. So this is why if you look at Proverbs 31 and you ask, you know, did women work in the ancient world? Well, yeah, you better believe it. Well, where did they work? Well, the same place as men, for the most part, in their homes, because the home is the center of production of what happens. This is where you're either involved in some kind of food production. You're definitely involved in food preparation. This is where you're involved in trying to secure the basics in terms of food, shelter, and clothing, right? Things that, if we're honest with ourselves, we can't do for ourselves in our culture. Right? This is why we need to earn money so we can pay other people and use that money to buy these basics. For most of history, the household is largely productive, that it is geared toward this process, whereas our culture is mostly consumptive. And so this is part of the debate. You know, I'll hear people talk about this, you know, should women work or not? I think we need to acknowledge that everybody is called, has some kind of vocation, has some kind of calling, to be productive. This is, you know, you look at Genesis 1 and you see that God establishes Adam and Eve in the garden and he gives them the call to take it, to take care of it, to tend it, right, to have meaning and purpose. And so if our vision of what it looks like to stay at home in a consumptive culture is stay home and be a consumer, that's not actually that fulfilling of a lifestyle, as many people in our culture well know, to say, just stay home and consume. Now, I think there are ways, even in our culture, to have a productive household. But I think part of Sayers' critique is all human beings, male and female, have a calling to use their gifts, their skills, and abilities as culture makers. And so for Christians especially to say, that is restricted, or maybe that some people don't have that kind of calling, it actually starts to affect who we are as human beings. I think you could look at this from another angle, even thinking about retirement in our culture. Retirement says, just save enough money so that you can just be a consumer. A lot of people realize then that their vision of retirement turns out not to be that great. That for a lot of retired folks is a question of, what am I going to do now? I think people who handle retirement well are people who say, my life should be meaningful, it should have purpose. I may not be at a job where I'm earning money, but I need to have a purpose, whether that's volunteering at church or whether that's getting involved in other ways, to just say, what's the point of life? Just to hang out and kind of buy stuff, right? There are certain people, like the Kardashians, who may think is that really what we want to be like? To just be consuming and be a celebrity? I don't think it's very fulfilling in the end. And you get stuck, with Kanye's, what, $53 million in debt, reportedly?
That's not good. That's not good.
He needs to make albums till he's 105, pay this off, and even then might not be coming close. So when we're talking about our calling and gender roles, I think we need to be aware of the fact that our own culture has often shaped the Christian discourse around this. To say that, I think just to say that a woman's call is to primarily be about her husband and family, when a man's calling is primarily to be about his job, I think that distorts both male and female roles. Shouldn't a man be just as focused on his marriage and family as the woman? I would think so. I think about this dynamic even in my marriage, where I have a job, but I don't think my wife has a calling that's any less than my calling. And in fact, our calling is one where we work together to achieve a unified goal. Right? Part of what I do is part of her calling. Because if she isn't called to do what she does, guess what? I've got four kids I got to take care of on a regular daily basis. And so she understands that our calling is a mutual calling, and we together work on this. And I think for a lot of couples, the idea that maybe you each have a job, or maybe one person has a job and you kind of do your thing and that's about it, doesn't end up very, very fulfilling in the end. One other video. This kind of takes us back to where our conversation went a minute ago. When we were talking and thinking about, and I'm wondering how this applies not just to feminine beauty, but to masculine beauty as well. But the focus here is especially on feminine beauty, and the fact that you have to carry purses because of the pocket thing. Really sorry that masculinity has done that to you. So that can be a reminder anytime a woman needs to ask a man to hold her purse. Like you've done this to us. So you actually should be the one holding the purse because this is your result. So this is just a brief video talking about how feminine beauty is socially constructed. And it's especially written from a feminist perspective that's going to raise the question about how this produces effects in women because of kind of the way that men want women to be. I think there's some naked bodies in this. Not real ones, cartoon naked bodies.
The French existentialist writer Simone de Beauvoir famously declares in her book The Second Sex that a woman isn't born a woman. Rather, she becomes one. She means by this that there is no way women have to be, no given femininity, no ideal to which all women should conform. There's biology, of course, and as a result, women's experiences tend to be very different from men's. But what it is to be a woman is, she believes, socially constructed, and largely by males at that. It is through other people's expectations and assumptions that a woman becomes feminine. Women, de Beauvoir argues, are expected to strive after beauty, a beauty that has been defined by men's view of what they would like women to be, a view that often denies their capacity for action and thought. There have been different ideals of feminine beauty at different times. times in different places, but the constant throughout history is that women have been encouraged to be passive objects, their bodies emphasized and displayed. Women are supposed to use artifice to make themselves ornamental, or as de Beauvoir saw it, disguise more animal aspects of their body, which men found unacceptable. Women's clothes and shoes frequently constrain their movement. Their beauty regimes take over their lives and drain their finances. They're controlled by other people's visions of what they should look like and how they should live. For young women in particular, the pressure to become an object to the male gaze, to be conventionally beautiful, to diet, to worry about makeup and jewelry, is intense. But it is still, according to de Beauvoir, resistible. True to her existentialism, she believes that women are fundamentally free to reject male stereotypes of beauty and sexual attractiveness, and to become more equal as a result.
Yeah. So when you see this, what do you think about it, man? I'm curious to hear and think about how this especially might work out, even in the context of youth groups. Like, what kind of pressures are there on women? What kind of pressures are there on men as well? And I don't know if there's been a shift here for men to conform to some kind of standard, or if it's always been there. But I wonder, how much is this... does this describe your experience as a man or a woman in terms of expectations, in terms of culturally having to live up to something? Yeah, Becca?
I was going to say, I know I grew up in Michiana, small town, farming community, everything like that. And I remember throughout junior high and high school getting a lot of pushback because I didn't like being a girly girl at all. Even when I was very little, I didn't like activities that were considered feminine. I mean, I enjoyed playing with dolls because from a very young age, I decided I wanted to be a mom. That's what I wanted to do with my life. But that was about the extent of femininity. I hated dresses. I would complain constantly every single Sunday that my mother made me wear a dress to the point she stopped trying when I was about 7 and just let me wear what I wanted.
Break those parents down.
I got in trouble with my preschool teacher because I constantly wanted to bring all the animals that I found outdoors into the classroom, and all of a sudden, halfway through afternoon, there would be a frog underneath my desk or other small animals. I dealt with a lot of pushback in elementary school because I wanted to hang out with the boys, not with the girls, because I got tired of the girls constantly talking about when their mom was going to let them wear makeup or when their mom was going to say, okay, now you can go shopping on your own and everything like that. I'm like, this is boring. Let's go hang out and play pirates. I'm done with this. I'm bored.
Yeah. Do boys have the same pressure as girls around their appearance? And I'm talking about, you know, boys into adolescence, teenagers.
I don't know. You want to look good. Right, am I right?
All
right. I think in high school I'm somewhat concerned about what girls are seeing. You know, I want to get, like, I'm in high school, I want to get a girlfriend, and I can't just wear whatever I want and look like trash, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Question is, though.
Girls ain't gonna like that.
Yeah.
Question is, though, is that a view that girls have, or is it what men have projected that girls should want that men should look like when they grow up?
Yeah.
That way too. So it has defined what men should look like.
Yeah. And just in terms of time, effort, like, this is a question I think it raises for me. The time and effort just devoted to appearance and clothes.
Yeah.
Is that similar? And I'm going to say no. Yeah.
I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not a male. But, like, I think their perspective, it's more focused on muscle, right? Like, strength and how strong you are and how toned you are and fit and,
Right?
Yeah.
Instead of like how good your hair is today or what kind of makeup you're
wearing. Yeah. You should spend your time in the gym instead of in the mirror. It's not like I spent an hour in front of the mirror this morning or something. Let's talk. Who else?
The whole beard.
Well, yeah, I was going to say something like that. I think guys have a reason to think that because they see all of the girls' celebrity crushes and they're all toned. They all have six packs. They all have huge biceps. Like, so there's, it's understandable why men feel this way to want big muscles and like that because all the posters in girls' rooms or their lockers in middle school or something, they're all of like very toned, fit guys.
Yeah, and so part of what I wonder is if, you know, even since, you know, this is talking about a philosopher who's thought, you know, is last century, about 80 years ago, has there been a shift to where, I wonder if we're at least starting to do more of this to men as well as women. So instead of saying, well, you know, we really are made more aware of how this functions for women, instead we're saying, you know, now this is something that men need to do as well and spend just as much time. And I'm not sure that's the helpful way to go. Yeah, sir.
I do think there is like a pressure on both sides, but for women there is more modification. I feel like that is more of the emphasis in changing your appearance. It's not just like have bigger muscles, it's like go get plastic surgery. We need to have like this certain body type. So go get plastic surgery, wear makeup. Maybe you need to straighten your hair, you need to curl your hair, like, just more modifications versus just...
Yeah. I mean, if you go into Meijer and look in the health and beauty section, how much of that is devoted to women versus men? I mean, yeah, Axe is trying to continually reinvent new products that men somehow need, with kind of the same mindset, but I think clearly... It kind of says that women in their natural state are needing much more improvement than men in their natural state. I saw a couple other hands. Anybody else want to chime in? Kaylee? No? Yeah, no. All right.
I'd say it takes me a while to get ready. I don't know if it's just because... maybe I'm more feminine. I think some of my guy friends would say I dress more feminine because my jeans are tight and I wear earrings and I style my hair. But I've had it like if I'm going on a date, I take forever and my hair has to be perfect. I have to style it forever. and I've changed clothes before. I've looked at it, I'm like, no, I'm gonna change my shirt. I've done that. But maybe that's just feminine.
I don't think there's anything else.
You know what I mean?
Dude,
well, I'm concerned if my hair has to be perfect and I have to wear the right clothes. Like, if I'm going on a date, but like,
yeah.
If not, I woke up in the morning, I didn't shower, and I put a hat on, and it's like.
Hypothetically! Hypothetically!
I'm like, I don't care now. I'm just going to throw a hat on. I don't even think about it. But sometimes it takes a while.
Yeah.
I think, like, going past appearance, more with the kind of fear that comes with being a woman sometimes, with catcalling and rape being a big thing and things like that. But it's gotten to a point where, like, if a guy compliments a girl, then she automatically assumes that he's flirting with her. Like, it's gotten to so bad that, like, guys can't even compliment women anymore because she takes it the wrong way.
Yeah.
And so like there's both, I don't know.
Yeah, how do you have that balance of saying it's okay to look nice and want to look nice. I think the point of this is to go deeper and say there is something that's imbalanced about this that this is part of what Sayer suggests, that even the push to say women should wear dresses or skirts has a level of sexual availability built into the way we see these kind of norms working.
Sort of going a little bit off of what you just said. One thing I observed with makeup specifically is, one, well, I would want to sort of cut them to say, you know, my 9-year-old wants to wear makeup, but, you know, I'm not going to let her yet because, you know, I wanted to keep her innocence. And that just seemed really telling of the core as a bigger picture is that somehow if you wear makeup, your innocence is somehow lost.
Yeah. It is an interesting remark. I mean, in terms of what does it imply then to wear makeup? Or what is
exactly.
that is there a sense of availability, right, that you're now thinking more in terms of the other sex, the other gender? And this is what I think is interesting about this as well, because I've had these conversations with my wife when I'm, how shall I describe this? When I'm reflecting on the fact that it takes her longer to get ready to go to church than it does me, and it's one of those things where I'm like, you know, whatever. But what I think is interesting is the way that what de Beauvoir talks about in terms of the male gaze, how the male gaze infiltrates how women look at each other. Because my wife will say, I'm not dressing this way for other men, and sometimes I'm dressing this way less for you than I am for the other women at church. Right? Because of that. And so I think that would be a further reflection from a feminist perspective to say, this kind of male way of thinking of saying women have to conform to this standard and they don't has so infiltrated women that women utilize that standard maybe in some ways more than men do as they judge each other and reflect on that. Yeah.
Well, you kind of said it. I was going to say that as the male way of looking at women has infiltrated the female mind, I would say the female way of like looking at themselves has infiltrated the male mind. So men are now critical of their own bodies and the way females are because they're thinking girls are looking at me just like girls are themselves because they're thinking boys are looking at them. But also girls are ruthless creatures when it comes to each other.
Yeah.
Like, I will never forget walking into Bilso Choir and this one girl goes, oh, you're doing your eyeshadow like that now? And I just was like, what does that mean? Like, is that good? Like, that is, what is that? I'm doing it like that? Does that, is it good like that? So,
yeah.
Girls can be ruthless with that kind of thing, but it's all because of boys. But boys are the same way to each other. We like spread this horrible self-consciousness disease.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a happy note to end on.
So, but I think you know. So in all of this is where I think that part of the good news that we have to offer, and this I think shows why it is an uphill battle. You know, especially if you're working with youth, you're working with people who are in the midst of this to say. How do we find value and worth in who we are as image bearers that God has made us to be, that it is not our conformity to some of these external standards that give us value and worth, but it's something deeper. And so I think this is where the church itself maybe needs to continue to think and rethink how it should be us who's helping to break down some of these expectations. Not just feminists out there or you know people who might say don't have any kind of connection to the Christian worldview, but Christians who are really saying, where do we get our value and worth from? And how does that drive us? All right, we'll stop there for today. I'll see you next time.
You're welcome.
I will post a worksheet for Sakai for next time a little bit later this afternoon, but it'll be on there.
I did that.